loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, for the third year in a row, American police officers have killed more than 1,000 people, even as the rates of violent crimes continue their historic declines. Next, Spain's Supreme Court has refused to release Catalan Vice President Oriol Junqueras, who has been in prison for 2 months because of his role in the region's push for independence. Meanwhile, former Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori was released from prison today after a controversial pardon on medical grounds. Then, French President Emmanuel Macron has announced plans to crack down on the so-called fake news that his country sees. Macron argues that he's protecting democracy, but critics see this move as a serious threat to free speech. And then the case of the J20 Trump inauguration protesters continues as a lawsuit alleges that the police pepper sprayed a 10-year-old as they broke up the demonstration. What will happen to the 188 protesters who still face charges? Finally, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages opened above 25,000 today for the first time ever. Is this a sign of a booming economy, or are we in a bubble? That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the issue of police killings. For the third year in a row, American police officers killed more than 1,000 people, even as the rates of violent crimes continue their historic declines. We're joined by Abraham Marquez. He's a community organizer and activist in Los Angeles. Abe, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Abe, how is it possible that with these dramatic decreases in violent crimes that we've seen really over the past what couple of decades now, we're seeing steadily that police are killing 1,000 or more people in America every year? How's that possible?
Yeah, it's a really sad number to see that, you know, for the last few years has been going over 1,000. I know in 2017, for police training, they spend seven times as many hours training to shoot than they did training to like de-escalate any situation. So it kind of tells you what their role is really when they come to any kind of situation.
That's an excellent point, because it is about training. It's about training, and it's also about impunity, because the police know if they shoot first and ask questions later, nobody else is going to be asking questions, and then nobody's going to charge them. Or very, very few of them, because all the police have to say, all of them know this,
yes,
is I feared for my life. I feared for my safety.
That's it.
So it is about that. It's a willful decision on the part of police departments not to stop this pandemic of police murder. It's not going on in other countries. I mean, this is an American thing.
No, and other countries don't provide military equipment to their local police departments. I've said on this show before, Brian, my eldest son graduated recently from Ohio State University at the very end of the Obama administration, and the Ohio State University campus police took delivery of a decommissioned tank. Now, what in the world would the police of a university need an armored tank for, other than to kill people?
Yeah, Abe, it is a trend. There's always been the phenomena of racism and the license to kill, but there is this phenomena of militarization going on at local police departments, or in the case that John just mentioned, even in college police departments.
Yeah. A few years ago here in Anaheim, you know, there was an uprising after, you know, numerous of police shootings, and, you know, the community came out, everyone came out in support for the families, and the police department came out in tanks, which, you know, there were some Iraq War veterans that were there, and they were just like, what is this going on? It's not a war that we're fighting. It's, you know, bringing on tanks onto the communities, and, you know, it's a scare tactic that they use so that people don't try to fight back against the police.
And what kind of community is Anaheim?
Anaheim is a very working class community, poor and working class, and it was about, I want to say, 3 years ago or so.
Let's just look at the numbers,
yeah.
John. I'm looking at theroot.com. Police officers killed 1,129 people in 2017. More people died from police violence in 2017 than the total number of U.S. soldiers killed in action around the globe. That number was 21.
Mm-hmm.
More people died at the hands of the police in 2017 than the number of black people who were lynched in the worst year of Jim Crow. That was 161 in the year 1892. Cops killed more Americans in 2017 than terrorists did. That number was 4. They killed more citizens than airplane deaths worldwide. And mass shooters, that was 428 deaths. I mean, these are staggering numbers. These are 3 people a day being shot dead by the police departments in America.
And then you have to ask how many police officers were actually charged with a crime. And the article goes on to say, out of the 1,129 people killed by the police in 2017, 12 police officers were charged with a crime. That's not to say any of those were convicted. I think perhaps one or two were.
One, yeah.
But the numbers just don't add up.
Hey, Marquez, it's a license to kill. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was another report that came out that they were able to identify out of that number, the 1147, there was 569 cases where 48 of those 569 were actually shot by a police officer who already had multiple prior shootings. And 12 of them had, 49 of the 569 had shot or killed someone before.
Yes.
And then out of that 48, 12 of them had multiple prior shootings, which is ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's true.
But there you have it. If the license to kill, the impunity, where a cop can be judge, jury, and executioner, and they get away with it once, they know they're going to get away with it another time, they're likely to do it. And of course, you have a system. We have the problem of police training and orientation towards especially black and Latino communities, where the cops look at the people as enemy combatants. In other words, like they would look at soldiers, not like fellow citizens or fellow, people in the community. Of the 534 killer cops mapping police violence was able to identify, and that's obviously not all of them, as Abe was mentioning, 43 had shot or killed someone else before. Most of the people killed, this is important, most of the people killed, that would be 718, were suspects in non-violent offenses, were stopped for traffic violations, or had committed no crime at all. That's a staggering number, Abe.
Yeah, it is. It is. I saw that too, that most of them were coming from, or a large percentage of them were coming from traffic violations. And I live in LA, and LA, you can't get anywhere without driving. You know, and you constantly live in that fear of what if a cop pulls you over and who knows what's going to happen? Which is, something that we have to deal with on a daily basis. It's ridiculous.
95 of the people who were killed were shot by the police when they were in a moving vehicle. That's basically banned police activity. Again, though, the cops are not getting arrested. They're not getting prosecuted. They're certainly not getting convicted for it. I mean, 95 people killed in a moving car. A moving vehicle. Just amazing. Abe, you've been active, I know, in the Los Angeles and Southern California area for a number of years. We had the movement for Black Lives, the Black Lives Matter movement. There's been lots of activity within the Mexican American and other communities. People of color have been in the streets, have been rising up. And at the same time, of course, because this epidemic of police violence doesn't stop, because the murders keep going and maybe growing, of course, it seems to, at a certain point, become a point of frustration for the movement. But nonetheless, there's no other recourse, it doesn't seem to me. Like, given the fact that this is just allowed, what other options do people have except to be in the streets?
You know, there's an article in Newsweek that talks about the release of this report. And it says something that's just so commonsensical that I think it bears noting. It says, police departments that have adopted certain policies have reduced the number of people they kill, but few departments have made such reforms. New policies like requiring officers to exhaust all other means before shooting, or requiring all officers to report all use of force, can reduce police killings by 25%, the report states. The problem is police departments just aren't doing that. They aren't adopting these reforms. Why do you think that is?
It's not in their interest. It's not the role that they play in society. They constantly want to patrol and harass working class communities, and it's not what they're trying to do.
You know, I'm looking at the numbers, John, for how many people the police in the UK, in United Kingdom, were killed. I could be wrong, but it looks to me like the number in the year 2017 was 4.
Right. That sounds right, actually.
4 people. 4 individuals. We have over 1,100 in the United States. It's just a shocking level of barbarism, I would say, and the fact that the powers that be tolerated, and as Abe said, maybe they don't care because this is the role of the police, just to function as an occupying force, a policing force, in communities where there's a lot of unemployment, a lot of poverty. The government is not spending the resources to provide education and job training and jobs and affordable housing for people. So you just police them. You look at them the way you would look at an enemy or foreign population and treat them as possible combatants. And then you adopt a military, a policing policy, which is essentially a military policy.
It is. And there's another component to this as well. The Washington Post says that fully a quarter of the people killed by police were mentally ill. And this is something that we just have never addressed as a nation. That is the levels of mental illness in this country and the police response to people with mental illness.
And of course, when you act like a homicidal maniac, you yourself could be accused of having a mental disorder. So it goes all the way around. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined by Abraham Marquez. He is a community organizer and activist in Los Angeles. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Spain's Supreme Court has refused to release Catalan Vice President Oriol Junqueras, who has been in prison for 2 months because of his role in the region's push for independence. Meanwhile, former Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori was released from prison today after a controversial pardon on medical grounds. We're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News' political analyst. Walter, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Walter, good things happen to some people, bad things happen to others. We've got Alberto Fujimori, or Fujimori as he's called in Peru, who is a bona fide monster, frankly, who has the blood of many, many hundreds, if not thousands of people on his hands. And he's actually released from prison on medical grounds. The moment he's released, it seems that his medical problems aren't as bad as they once were. And then on the other side, you have a Catalan politician who wants nothing more than independence for his nation, and he's not allowed out of jail.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous when you compare these two developments, which are, you know, happening on the same day. So Oriol Junqueras, who's the leader of the ERC, the Republican Left of Catalonia, which is, you know, like the center left, social democratic pro independence party in the region, and which is also, you know, one of the most popular parties in the region. He, you know, his party just narrowly missed becoming the largest party in the pro independence camp in the last regional election. You know, he was refused bail on the grounds that, well, if he gets out, then maybe he will go back to supporting the independence movement, which is a crime, and so we can't let him out. And then you have Alberto Fujimori, who, he's a dictator. I mean, he ruled the country for about 10 years. He presided over a period of Peruvian history where to combat the insurgencies by two left-wing guerrilla groups, the Shining Path and the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, set up, you know, death squads. He forcibly sterilized 200,000 to 300,000 indigenous women, and was horribly corrupt by all accounts. So he's out. And yeah, his medical condition is not as bad as it seems. In fact, he's actually jumping into the country's politics already.
I think, John, this all started with the mafia crime family. You know, like whenever they were about to, you know, the trial was in the last stage. Very sick. They had a heart attack. They were in
a microphone boom hits Uncle Junior in the head and he falls down the steps.
Yes. Yeah, and Hosni Mubarak took a page from the mafia.
That's right.
And he got very sick. Remember, he was showing up in court in a stretcher all the time.
Well, CNN actually declared him dead at one point in 2009.
Yeah, so he was that sick. And then the charges were dropped a few years later after the coup, and
lo and behold,
he's better.
He's reclaimed his health.
Yeah, it's remarkable. He went out of the the hospital in a wheelchair, so he was kind of keeping up appearances a little bit that way. But
when seen doing wind sprints a few hours later.
Yeah, right. So he he's so bold, and I mean, he doesn't have any reason not to, because he got a full pardon. I mean, it's like he's
right. He doesn't
not a
have
criminal.
To pretend or hide. He got a full pardon. He can do whatever he wants now at this point.
Yeah, totally. So his first order of business, it's being speculated, is reconciling his two children who lead hostile factions of the same political party.
So let's go back to Catalonia, because here you have a peaceful movement for. Well, you know, it's not even for independence. Some sectors of the people who are voting for independence are actually for independence. And then other people are just for the idea that the people in Catalonia, in Barcelona, they should have the right to divorce. That doesn't mean that they want to divorce, but they want that democratic right.
That's right.
And now you have the leaders of that movement. Some are in exile, some are in prison. What's the calculation, Walter, with the Spanish central authorities? I mean, it would seem to me, given the fact that they're putting these people, political leaders and leaders from the Catalonia government and leading political leaders of political parties in prison and keeping them there without bail, that if anything, that would stoke the support for independence, or does it have the opposite? Is the intimidation concept, the coercive concept, is it actually impacting?
Well, I think that the Spanish central government, their initial response to the referendum, or the response on the day of the referendum, which was to unleash, you know, massive police violence on the population that was just trying to vote, was a major miscalculation on their part, in addition to being, you know, this horrible violation of democratic rights that people have. And I think that's why people are greeting, you know, the continued imprisonment of Junqueras as such a, you know, such an injustice, especially when you compare it to what's happening with Fujimori, because, you know, it was a peaceful event, right? It was a vote. It's sort of like a democratic expression, and whatever you think about Catalan independence, that, you know, most people agree that should be their right to, you know, have a democratic say in their future. Now, I think what the Rajoy government is thinking, you know, since they've successfully implemented Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution, which gives the central government the authority to disband the regional governments of any one of the, what it's called in Spain, autonomous communities, kind of like provinces, but a little bit more than that. Because they were able to successfully implement that, and there wasn't, you know, there are big demonstrations, but there wasn't, you know, like an indefinite general strike or something like that, you know, because they were able to weather that storm. I think now they're thinking, we just can crush them and we can get away with it because the 1978 Constitution gives us more or less unlimited authority to do so.
So, Walter, the Catalonians have had their election. They've actually had two elections. They've been very clear as to what it is that they wanted. And yet they seem to be in this sort of holding pattern. Is this going to have to be decided where? At the Spanish Supreme Court? In Madrid? In the government? How is this going to play out?
Well, one option is for the Rajoy government to just keep invoking Article 155. I mean, they theoretically could, if they wanted to, just keep disbanding the government until they get the election result that they wanted. I think what they were initially hoping would happen is that the pro-independence parties would boycott the election that they just had in December, because, you know, it's a violation of their right to sovereignty. You know, we already had an independence referendum. We declared independence. So this is just a sham election. That's what I think they were hoping the Catalan pro-independence parties would do. But that's not really what happened. They did participate in the polls. Their share of the seats, I think they got two fewer seats than they did the first, you know, in the 2015, I believe, regional election. Their share of the vote was virtually the same. And so it is a stalemate at this point. It remains to be seen if there's anything that can be done. I think the Rajoy government is thinking, well, look, we'll just wait out the clock. You know, nothing happening is good for us. And so the onus, I think, is on the newly elected but still sort of in formation Catalan pro-independence government to come up with a strategic path forward.
And finally, let's pop back to Peru, because in both cases, there's the government, there's repression, and there's also the people. In the case of Peru, we have thousands of people in Lima who have been in the streets for the past days, protesting against this pardon of Fujimori.
Yeah, the left in Peru, the progressive movement that, you know, bore the brunt of the repression during the Fujimori era is definitely mobilizing. They also had a bit of a breakthrough in the most recent election. There's this new formation called the Broad Front. Their presidential candidate, Veronica Mendoza, did, a lot better than expected. They're the third largest party in parliament. They have 20 seats there. And so I think that this may have the effect of stimulating those forces to continue taking to the streets to speak out against this obvious injustice that's been carried out by the government of Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, at the urging or sort of as part of a deal made with the pro-Fujimori party that has a majority in the Peruvian parliament.
I think that's all the time we have. Walter Smolarek has been our guest. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear, but he's also a Sputnik political news analyst. Walter, thank you so much. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
French President Emmanuel Macron has announced plans to crack down on so-called fake news. Macron argues that he's protecting democracy, but critics see this move as a serious threat to free speech. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Alexander, in a democratic society, is it even possible to block something that may or may not be fake news? Can you block websites in this day and age?
Well, the answer is that you probably can, but if you are in a real democratic society, you shouldn't. And of course, one of the things about France is that it often sets itself up to be a country which is at the forefront of free speech. It has long argued and claimed to be at the forefront of free speech. There was a few years ago, at the time of the episode with Charlie Hebdo, there were the terrorist attack on Charlie Hebdo. There were big demonstrations in France about defending the right to free speech, and here we see the president of France himself appearing to go against the tradition in France, extending all the way back to the French Revolution, in which people have free speech and in which this is seen traditionally as being an indispensable part of a democratic society and part of the French political tradition, the French revolutionary tradition, which lies at the center and the core of all Western democratic liberal democracies.
Interestingly enough, what Macron is proposing, he's proposing, in his words, to protect democracy. He says here, if we want to protect liberal democracies, we must have strong legislation. Beyond that, the new law will see the role of France's media watchdog, the CAS, expanded in order to deal with attempts to destabilize the situation in the country by broadcasters, quote, controlled or influenced by foreign states. The CAS will be granted the right to refuse, suspend, or cancel agreements with such broadcasters based on their content, including online publications.
That's Russia, right?
It has to be. There's really nobody else in the mix.
It is Russia. And of course, during the recent presidential election in France, which Macron won, he actually identified Russia, and so did people in his campaign.
Yes, specifically RT and Sputnik, as a matter of fact.
Sputnik, indeed, exactly. And in fact, he's refused them accreditation, as I understand it. So it is clearly Russia. And I think this is another point I wanted to make, because, of course, he talks about defending liberal democracy. There is nothing remotely liberal about what Macron is doing. If we go back to the tradition in France, well, Voltaire didn't actually say that, you know, I disagree completely with your opinions, but I will, you know, I believe you have an absolute right to them. He didn't say that, but he might have said that. And that is the tradition in France. And that is the liberal tradition, and not just in France. It is the liberal tradition everywhere. So when these people say that they are liberals, they are not liberals at all. They are the opposite of liberals. They are the new authoritarians. They want to control the media space, and they're doing it in order to preserve the political status quo, which benefits them personally. And that is the agenda that they are following.
And they must, because you can't carry out authoritarian measures in a place like France or here or the UK and say, guess what, we're doing this in the name of authoritarianism. I mean, that doesn't sell. That doesn't play. So there has to be a noble cause. And the noble cause in the suppression of democratic options in the media, the noble cause is to protect democratic options.
That's right.
Well, that is exactly the point. That is exactly the shuffle, or if you like, the trick which is being pulled. You attack democracy in the name of democracy. You attack free speech in the name of free speech. And, of course, what you do at the same time is you set yourself up as the gatekeeper. You say that you're the person who knows what is in the great interests of the people and of democracy and of the proper functioning of the political system and of liberalism. And, of course, when you do that, you cannot really call yourself a liberal and a Democrat. But if you control all the sources of information, then that becomes possible to say, because who is left to contradict you?
Yeah, and if we go just in terms of this wordplay, where everything means the opposite, it was the French in particular who were, in the name of defending humanity, defending civilians in Libya, insisted that the U.S. and Britain and NATO go bomb Libya and rain thousands of bombs and missiles down in the name of protecting people. All these words mean their opposite. And of course, as Alexander is saying, John, if there's nobody left standing, either because they've been censored or because they've engaged in self-censorship, which is
just as damaging.
And I think part of what this is all about is to make everybody think, if it comes from Sputnik or if it comes from RT, it comes from a Russian media source, the assumption is that it's fake. And thus, if you believe that, if you use that, if you source that, then you're fake.
Right.
And you're participating in sort of a debauchery against democracy. But that's the real message.
It is the real message, that it's okay to be anti-democratic. It's okay to be undemocratic. It's okay to be against free speech and still call yourself a Democrat.
And I would add something else, which is, of course, the specific reason why RT and Sputnik are being targeted is precisely because they are out of reach. They are not agencies that can be controlled by the French authorities, by Monsieur Macron and his people, in the way that, say, a French newspaper or television channel.
That's true.
Or publication.
They're out of reach.
Exactly. So that is why there is this particular venom directed at them. Because, of course, if you have an aspiration to completely control not just the media space, but the entire narrative, the whole dialogue, then anybody who is dissenting against that dialogue and who is expressing an alternative view of it, and you absolutely pointed the correct finger at the extraordinary discrepancies of what you're doing, anybody who points at that is by definition a danger. And if you can't control them, well, you have to try some other way to discredit them. And that's why we see the attack on RT and on Sputnik that we are seeing.
That's an excellent point. They're out of reach, meaning they can't be disciplined by the American political or media establishment. You know, John, we have had on this show probably 900 guests over the past 2 years.
Sure.
RT has had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of guests. People who are, you know, some are great speakers, some are less great. A lot of them have something very important to say, and there's a lot of expertise. The thing that they almost all have in common is that they can't be allowed to be on U.S. corporate-owned mainstream media. You don't see their voices.
Brian, I've said this a million times. When I first got out of prison, I wanted to talk about whistleblowing, specifically about national security whistleblowing, and I would have been delighted to go on CNN and MSNBC and even Fox. But those corporate-owned media outlets don't cover the issues that are important to me, like national security whistleblowing. RT does.
Mm.
And Al Jazeera does.
Mm.
And so I was delighted to appear on RT, and I've done it dozens of times. I'm glad that I did.
Yeah.
There's nothing fake about it at all.
And now you've been listed along with all those other RT guests as
right. A useful idiot. Thank you, George Soros.
We have 90 seconds left, Alexander. Go ahead.
One mustn't despair, because, of course, the point is that these sort of attacks, they also betray the vulnerability, because the aspiration to completely control the media space is actually impossible. I mean, Macron and people like him are simply going to undermine the credibility, ultimately, of the institutions that they are trying to defend, and of the and of the political systems that they are trying to defend. They are a sign of the growing nervousness and weakness of the political systems in the West, that they feel they have to take these steps. A strong, self-confident, democratic system, such as we are no longer we're seeing under challenge, doesn't need these type of controls. And in fact, it not only doesn't need these sort of controls, it is set in opposition to them.
Yeah, you're living in the free world. Don't you dare try to listen to media that we've deemed to be fake. Don't you dare go to countries that we've decided to sanction and target. It's a very particular kind of freedom. It's a very particular kind of democracy. And I think if the trend continues, all people of conscience, wherever you lie in the political spectrum, we all have to fight back against this tendency. And I think we can win, because I think Alexander is right. These guys are tilting against windmills. They can't really suppress the way they'd like to alternative media. Anyway, John Kiriakou, I think we're completely out of time.
We are indeed. We were joined from London by Alexander McCurris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. We will be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The case of the J20 Trump inauguration protesters continues as a lawsuit alleges that the police pepper sprayed a 10-year-old as they broke up the demonstration. What will happen to the 188 protesters who are still facing charges? We're joined from Washington by Chip Gibbons. He's policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. Chip has contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. Chip, welcome back to the show.
Always an honor to be on with Loud and Clear. Always.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Thanks for doing this. I have a question. We saw just a few weeks ago acquittals on all charges of the first group of individuals who were brought to trial. We have 188 more people. Has the Justice Department learned anything from that first set of trials?
Well, later that day, the same day of the acquittal, the Justice Department put out a public statement saying that they were going to proceed with the other 188 charges. So they're very gung-ho about continuing on this process. So I would have to say the Justice Department has learned absolutely nothing. I don't know why they think they're going to prevail on the remainder of the cases, but they're really committed to doing this.
You know, interestingly enough, when, and we talked about this the last time you were on the show, when a Code Pink protester was arrested for laughing at Jeff Sessions during his nomination hearing, the reason she was found guilty, according to the jurors who spoke to the press afterward, was because the law was so broadly written that they couldn't find her not guilty. That's not the case with these protesters. This just seems to be an issue of logic, that there really is no way to find the protesters guilty. And it surprises me that the Justice Department doesn't realize that and just walk away.
It's really interesting that you should mention that, because they're actually being charged under the DC Felony Rioting Act, or the DC Riot Act, I'm sorry, which is one of the vaguest and most open-ended rioting statutes in the country. It was challenged in the 60s as being unconstitutional. It was passed by Congress. This is before Home Rule, in response to the uprisings after Martin Luther King's assassination. There's a really great article about its very racist origins, and it's an extremely broad law, and The judge gives the jury instructions, and in the U.S. justice system, the deck is stacked in favor of the prosecution, and they still cannot win this case. I mean, like, on the one hand, it is an absurd case. I used to say it was paper thin. It's not even paper thin. But on the other hand, when you look at all of the miscarriages of justice, your trial included, that go on in this system, I'm seldom optimistic about the criminal justice system. But I think this is just such a grotesque example of overreach that the government has just gone too far, and no jury is going to go along with it.
This was the reintroduction into Washington policing of demonstrations of a tactic that the police used to use all the time. It's called trap and detain, kettling. People are not given a warning, not given a dispersal order. They have no ability to comply with something that has now been declared by the police to be unlawful. And it seems like it's an attempt to sort of roll the clock back, turn the clock back to the good old days when the police routinely did this. I think, Chip, that maybe what the prosecution had been counting on was that you have 200 people. Most of them are not even charged with having thrown a rock through a window or anything like that, because we know a few windows were broken, but they were in proximity to the demonstration when it was kettled. I assume because the charges were so heavy that the police felt, or the prosecution felt, that some of them would just start to plead guilty, and that once they started to plead guilty, the government wins the case.
That's right.
But these people did not plead guilty. They actually went to trial, which is very, I mean, given the conviction rate, very brave.
Yeah, it's very brave because the chances of winning are almost nil.
Yeah.
And they won.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the underreported angles of the story is the solidarity amongst the defendants. There is a group that is a defendant-led resistance group to the charges. They put out a statement of solidarity. They all agree they weren't going to cooperate with the prosecution against one another. So it's just a tremendous example. And there's been a fantastic organizing by the D.C. Legal Posse and other groups to just build a culture of solidarity amongst the defendants, because, you know, if the state can't break their solidarity, the state is far less likely to prevail.
Let's talk about the ACLU lawsuit. A 10-year-old boy, the police during these events on January 20th, day one of the Trump administration, apparently knocked him over, pepper sprayed him. The ACLU is... maybe there are other attorneys as well, have filed a lawsuit back in June alleging that the Metropolitan Police Department here in Washington, D.C. violated the Constitution and local laws when it unlawfully detained and used unnecessary force, including pepper spray, on peaceful demonstrators on January 20th. Frisbee Fulton is the mom, and her son, the 10-year-old, were added to the lawsuit on Wednesday. Talk about that case.
Sure. There were two really interesting amendments made to the lawsuit on Wednesday. The first one is the one that you mentioned. They added the mom, Frisbee Fulton, the 10-year-old son. There's actually video I've seen. It is very horrific, of police pepper spraying the 10-year-old while protesters, you know, the evil anarchists, shield the 10-year-old from the police. And it's a really disturbing video to watch. And I mean, the entire narrative of the, you know, heroic police taking on the bad protesters, when you see, you know, protesters defending a 10-year-old from being pepper sprayed by a full-grown adult and riot gear. I mean, it's beyond despicable. But the other addition was they actually have named the majority of the police officers. And the ACLU has made a really interesting point that, unlike the DOJ, which is going for group liability and guilt by association, they're carefully picking out 27 officers. They have their names, they have their badge numbers, and they have specific allegations about specific uses of force. So it's sort of the exact opposite of the DOJ strategy. It is literally getting the police who committed the excessive acts of force. The only officer that still is not named is the officer that was accused of the very intrusive strip search, which included manual rectal probing of two of the defendants. They don't know the name of that officer yet. It's really another sort of shocking thing that a police officer would do that to people who are just kettled or at all.
Chip, let me ask you about that legal strategy, if I could. The individual police officers are named. They will undoubtedly assert, and the MPD will assert, that they must be granted immunity, that they, as a reasonable police officer in the course of their duty that day, dealing with a crowd that was infected by violence, as they will undoubtedly say, that they should have immunity. Then how does it go forward? How will that determination actually be made about whether these individual officers in mass or each of them in particular will be granted immunity or not immunity? Because it would seem like that will be the first test for this lawsuit.
Yeah, I'm not 100% certain to answer that question. I do know they are alleging the individual officers engaged in excessive force and violations of the Constitution. And while there has been a history of using the doctrine of qualified immunity to try to shield law enforcement officers from individual suits, there is federal law that allows you, when federal rights are violated, to bring suit against them. So there are limits. And I don't know what the status of qualified immunity is in D.C. I mean, some jurisdictions have done away with it in part or completely. So I'm not familiar enough with the ins and outs of D.C. law.
Chip, I want to tell our listeners, too, that the video that you're referring to is also on Newsweek. If they'd like to look for it, they can find it there at www.newsweek.com. And the article is entitled, "Cops Knocked Down and Pepper Sprayed a 10-Year-Old Boy Peacefully Protesting Trump's Inauguration," suit says.
He doesn't look like a big 10-year-old.
No, I mean, I've got a 10-year-old, and this is a small 10-year-old. And the poor kid, there are still photos in this article as well of the poor kid on his mother's shoulders crying after he's been not just pepper sprayed by the cops, but then trampled at the same time. And when the mother asked a cop for help, can we go down this side street where there were no protesters, all he said was, "You should have never brought your kid here."
Yeah, because we're going to pepper spray that boy.
Mm-hmm.
So shocking that the line about the police officer saying that. The other interesting thing, though, is that one of the people who pled guilty earlier and has already served 4 months in prison, Dane Powell, he actually helped the mother and the child escape from the police violence. And she had written a letter during his sentencing in support of him, explaining how he had helped her. And he went to jail for 4 months. And the officer who has pepper sprayed the 10-year-old, as far as I know, has had no repercussions thus far against them. Perhaps they will after the ACLU lawsuit. Perhaps they won't. Police usually go unpunished for their crimes. And the thing about the mother and the child is that they weren't even in the group that was arrested. They kettled the people and held them for a long period of time. And part of the allegations that they denied them, you know, rights to use a restroom. One of the police officers told them they wanted to use the restroom. They should have not gotten arrested. The police threw out edible food in front of them as they held them detained at this intersection. The mother and the child, along with the legal observer, they were in a different group of peaceful protesters who gathered where the people were arrested and were chanting things like, let them go, which is totally your First Amendment right. And the police, just without warning, unleashed pepper spray and sting balls against these entirely peaceful protesters, entirely separate from the group that was arrested that they claimed was engaged in vandalism. Obviously, know that charge is nonsense, but even under the police's logic, this is a really aggressive act against peaceful people.
Yeah, and I know because I was there along the parade route where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people all along the parade route where they're protesting. There were a ton of children. There were so many kids. This idea that the parents shouldn't bring their children to a protest. Well,
ridiculous.
People didn't expect to be set upon by the police. They have the right to engage in First Amendment activity. The message was to families, come, you know, your rights are protected. This is Washington, D.C. You have a right to protest. And so, of course, a lot of parents were absolutely shocked when they and their children were being attacked by the cops. I mean, that's actually mm-hmm. what went down.
Yeah, this was aggression on the part of the police, plain and simple.
We're going to leave it there, John. We've been joined by Chip Gibbons. Chip is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. He has contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. After a very short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The Dow Jones Stock Index opened above 25,000 today for the first time ever. Is this a sign of a booming economy or are we in a bubble? We are joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College, whose latest book is Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Welcome, Dr. Rasmus. So end of their ropes, bankers at the end of their ropes. Is that like a hanging rope?
Yes, of course.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure we're talking about hanging bankers here.
It's got a double meaning. It means that they have no other solutions.
Right.
They're in retreat and everything's being turned over to fiscal policy tax cuts as a way of the state subsidizing capital incomes. We subsidized for 7 years with near zero interest rates, and now that has reached its limits, causing financial bubbles. So the elites of this country are shifting now to fiscal policy and tax cuts. And we see that in the recent multi-trillion dollar tax cuts focused primarily on investors and corporations.
Let's talk about the idea of a bubble, Professor. Today's Wall Street Journal, of course, has a banner headline across the entire paper. Dow hurtles past 25,000 to record. And underneath it has almost as prominent a headline, many investors bailed out early, and it says that nearly $1 trillion has been pulled from retail investor mutual funds since the start of 2012. Well, the implication is that a lot of people out there think this is a bubble. And while the stock market has gone up something like 400% since 2009, corporate profits haven't, corporate revenues haven't. Isn't that sort of the definition of a bubble?
Well, you know, definitions of bubble depend on what you think is too much too fast. Mm. But clearly, this is a bubble. There is no set definition of a bubble. But, you know, it going up to 25-30% this year, that's damn close to bubble territory. And I think it really is a bubble. You know, the Wall Street Journal article is a little misleading because people pulling out of mutual funds are recycling a lot of them right back into exchange-traded funds, ETFs, which are even more risky. I think ETFs are the subprime mortgage derivative bomb of the next financial crash here. You know, it's not as if they're getting out of the markets. I think it's the herd is chasing the market up. There is going to be a bubble correction here, just as there will be with bitcoins and cryptocurrencies now underway. But, you know, my prediction is we're looking at a financial asset market correction of major proportions in early 2019. And of course, that kind of a correction will result in the next recession, I believe, in the U.S. In about 2019, maybe 2020. But it's coming.
As long as you predict an economic crisis is coming, you can't be wrong, because there is a cyclical aspect to what this economy or any capitalist economy goes through. There is the boom bust cycle. What I'd like to have you sort of talk about for a minute or two is what might make this different, say, than the crash or the depression or recession, the great correction of 2007-2008. During that time, or in the decade before that, there was a vast expansion of housing construction in the United States as a consequence of cheap credit. And then the banks, of course, were inducing people who couldn't really finance a mortgage or a mortgage at a particular interest rate to go ahead and buy it. That was the kind of predatory lending. All kinds of laws and fraud was committed, laws broken and fraud committed to do that because of the fees that were garnered by both real estate and banking entities. And then, of course, at a certain point, the housing prices were too high and there was too much housing that could be bought back at a profit, and the market collapsed. The housing market collapsed and housing prices collapsed, and all of those bad bank loans could not be recovered. And the government stepped in and bailed out the biggest banks, at least. It drew a circle around them and said, you will not fail. You are too big to fail and too big to jail. What's the difference now, do you anticipate, between what's coming and what happened?
You know, it wasn't just the subprime mortgage and the housing industry that was the heart of it. That was just a precipitating cause. The entire credit system was fragile. In my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I lay out what I predict is coming in terms of instability in the financial system, which has continued to grow. Household debt is greater than it was in 2007, and corporate debt is far greater than it was then. And of course, we know the government debt is now $20 trillion just in the U.S. The next crisis will not come out of housing and subprime mortgages or mortgages in general. It may not even initiate in the United States because it's a global financial system. There's over $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans, and we know in places like Italy it's serious, but also in China, could come from China. It could come out of some emerging market, major economy, or it could occur in the stock market or the cryptocurrency markets. You know, these are all psychologically very, very much integrated with each other. And when one of them goes, after people have made so much money, you know, out of the boom here in the last 7 years, they made so much money, they look for an excuse to take their money and run. And when that happens, the contagion, psychological contagion, spreads very fast. So it could come from anywhere, but the higher the bubbles go, the more likely it's going to happen, and the greater the contagion psychological effect is going to occur.
Hey, let's say for a moment that Donald Trump is the greatest economic thinker of his generation. Is there any kind of policy that he can implement right now that will either head off a correction or allow for a soft landing? Or are we going to just have to tough this out?
Well, you know, you got to think of Donald Trump as a shadow banker, speculator, because that's what he is. You know, he's real estate, a wheeler dealer, commercial real estate wheeler dealer. You know, he's right up there with the Adelsons and the Mercers. These are the big finance capitalists who are really running the show behind the scenes. I mean, there was a big headline today about how Steve Bannon is having his knuckles wrapped by the Mercer family, who was a big supporter of Trump. So, you know, this is a wing of the capitalist class in the country, the finance capitalist class, that is in battle with the other traditional wing over what kind of policies. And you know, the president really has very little, this guy especially, that he can or will do once the crisis erupts again. I mean, what are they going to do? Lower interest rates? Well, they're already, even though they raised them a little bit, they're already sitting on the floor. There's not much to go there. They'll probably go and do more QE, quantitative easing, buy up the bad debts above market prices and subsidize the losses. What are they going to do? Cut taxes some more? Well, corporate tax cuts only result in more financial asset investment or hoarding of cash or moving it offshore. It doesn't produce real investment much anymore. That's a big change in 21st century capitalism. What have they got to do? Well, they may be innovative and come up with something new, but you can bet that it'll only be to bail out the investor class. It won't be to bail out the rest of us, which we've seen already since the last crash. But the next one, we're going into households, 130 million households, far more fragile than they ever were before. And that's going to be a big factor in the collapse of consumer spending and household spending. And corporations are really in debt, because one of the consequences of 7 years of near zero interest rates is that they've loaded up on corporate bond and commercial paper debt. And, corporate debt is greater than ever before. And the problem when you have a crash in financial asset prices is the debt is still there, got to be paid, but there's no income flows to pay it. And that means it leads to defaults, and the cycle spins down even further. So, no, I don't see this guy Trump. You know, he's not the brightest pencil in the box, sharpest pencil in the box. And he's really doing what the Mercers and the Adelsons and all those really want him to do. You know, he calls them every night almost and says, what should we do now? What should we do now? He's not much of an independent thinker. He's not much of a thinker at all, and certainly doesn't know much about economics. He knows about wheeling and dealing and stealing, but I wouldn't qualify him to come up with solutions to a crisis that's inevitable.
Professor, we've got about 30 seconds left. Just for my own edification, it's always been my understanding that sort of a typical correction, or at least the textbook definition of a correction is a drop of about 10% in stock prices. What kind of a correction are you talking about here? Is it something more serious than that?
Oh, yeah, I think it's going to have to be well over 20%. You know, it was barely a year ago that the Dow was at 15,000, and now it's, 40% even higher. I would see at least the 20 to 30% correction when it comes. But, you know, when these things happen, they snowball, and it's hard to predict because you don't know what other shoes are going to drop where, and that will accelerate the whole process.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking with Dr. Jack Rasmus. We've been talking to him from California. He is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College. His latest book is Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. Also at SputnikNews.com and as an iTunes podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.
Love.